speak and after your speech, question and answer.
Pasquale, thank you very much indeed. And let me begin by acknowledging what you just said, that it is very true that that of the handful of distinctions that I have accumulated over the years, the one of which I am by far and away the most proud is my membership in the LIDCE, which I owe, I think, to the initiative of Professor Luigi Pazzinetti, who those of us who have had the privilege of knowing him and working with him, I think, generally regard as the greatest of the living economic theorists and one of the greatest economists of the past century. You also mentioned that in 2008 I was invited. This was actually by a college in southern Ohio to give their 25th annual Milton Friedman Memorial Lecture. The experience reminds me of something that a newspaper columnist said when the University of Texas appointed me to a chair, which is that it was proof that God had a sense of humor. And I immediately wrote to my friend, then quite ill, and the great conservative news journalist, magazine editor, and novelist William F. Buckley, saying that I had received this honor and that he couldn't write about it because it would immediately be revoked if it became known. And an email came back, I think one of the last that Buckley ever sent, that simply said, "A wonderful opportunity to repent," which, needless to say, I did not do. I have been engaged for many years now in attempting to make sense of inequality in the world. And Professor Tridico mentioned, this has resulted in a number of books, the most recent of which on that topic was in 2012. What I want to do tonight, or this afternoon, I should say, is to show you some work that is even more recent than that, and that attempts to bring our measures of the movement of inequality into contact with some of the most prominent policy arguments and also theoretical arguments that have been made about this subject in recent years, even more recently, one might even say this year, recent months. This is a subject about which, to which a great many people are suddenly being attracted, and certain premises are being advanced which certainly bear close and skeptical examination. Now, I want to begin, since I am above all a policy economist and a policy professor, by laying out for you a couple of ideas which will serve as backdrop, or if you like, foils for the evidence and the arguments that I want to make myself. The first one, I think, is entirely conventional, and one with which I'm sure as Europeans you've been familiar for many years. And the second one is more recent. The first one is, of course, a standard microanalysis. We'll call it the mainstream micro-wisdom. And it derives from a slightly extended version of a very ordinary supply and demand argument that relates primarily to the distribution of skills in the labor force and the impact of technology on the demand for skills. Something that's been part of the literature for at least 20 years, And part of the policy rhetoric for at least that long, but very insistently so in Europe. And the idea here is that the appropriate way to deal with an increasing importance of advanced technology is to allow labor markets to respond in a flexible way, that this will promote market clearing, prevent unemployment, and if you have flexible labor markets, that you will get a ready access to jobs. Whereas, on the contrary, rigid labor markets, which may be in the interest of certain clientels for certain purposes, will generate chronic unemployment. And of course, the typical comparison that was made over a long period of time is between the United States and Europe, where the US was given to be the example of the first case, Anglo-Saxon flexible labor markets, high inequality, full employment, but plus misery. And the European alternative was thought to be, and particularly in the US, but thought to be a vaguely socialistic insistence on rigid labor markets, equal distribution of wages, a social model in which the price is high unemployment. A very standard conventional view. And one thing that's interesting about it is that's a view which is largely accepted on both sides of the Atlantic and largely accepted by both the left and the right. And the argument is not over the conceptualization. The argument is over which of the two one prefers. Right-wingers and Americans prefer the American model with unemployment and misery, full employment and misery, and left-wingers and Europeans prefer the European model with social justice and joblessness, allegedly. This is a first proposition that I want to suggest should be examined very closely in light of evidence. And I've done that in past articles. Second proposition, much more recent, has been an effort to bring the study of inequality, move it from the microsphere to the macrosphere. And this is certainly achieved great impetus and prominence with the publication this year, in English, this last year in French, of Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century. And the proposition, the core proposition of Piketty's Capital, is that the movement of inequality under capitalism is, to a degree, inexorably upward, as a result of the fact that the rate of return on financial assets, on capital, tends to exceed the rate of growth of the real economy, G, thereby promoting an ongoing accumulation in the hands of those who hold capital. It's not all of Piketty's argument, but it's a central piece of it, and it does suggest a certain policy fatalism might be in order. That is to say that capitalism is what it is, and you should accept it, or if you don't accept it, you're pushed to a certain policy. Extremism is too strong a word, but let's say very forceful policy alternatives, and the one with which Professor Piketty has been associated is the idea that we ought to evaluate everybody's financial assets on an ongoing basis and then tax them every year on the global, in some kind of global tax scheme, anybody who's ever heard of Luxembourg, particularly in the last few days, might think is a fairly implausible political goal. I want to begin with this second hypothesis just to raise some questions about it. Because when Professor Piketty articulated the hypothesis, he confirmed essentially that there was one significant exception to it. As an empirical matter, that exception was, well, it was the 20th century. Which, I guess, in my humble view, since my own life doesn't go back before the 20th century, and I doubt that any of yours do either, is a fairly significant exception. And in dealing with that exception, Professor Piketty basically relied on a number of different things. The welfare state is part of it. But a major piece of his argument was that there was a lot of destruction of capital, and therefore, as a result of the wars, or in the course of the wars, and that this had a particular effect on diminishing inequality. It's an argument which does not have a lot of basis in history. If you think about World War I, a war that preceded aerial combat, bombardment, right, substantially, aerial bombing. There was almost no destruction of capital except in Belgium. France had very little, as Keynes discovered in 1919. Germany had none. United States, Britain, practically none. Italy, again, none. Countries were not destroyed in World War I except for the immediate areas of the battlefield. World War II, okay, Germany, Japan. But the value of the capital that was destroyed in Germany was, well, it turned out to be much less than was thought during the war. German industrial production continued to rise until 1945. In Japan, well, what was burned were cities that were made of wood. Capital valuation is not entirely clear. Recovery in both cases, therefore, was quite rapid. So what actually happened in the 20th century was not that. What actually happened in the 20th century was the emergence of modern economic institutions. And with respect to the rate of return on capital, those institutions had two major elements. One was taxation of capital, of profits. And the other was consumption out of capital, the recycling of capital into public or semi-public consumption, or by the rich themselves. Both of which, if you take the tax rate and the capitalist consumption as a share of GDP, will tend to reduce the relevant construct of the return on capital so that it's no longer clear that the rate of return on capital would be naturally higher than the growth rate. It might be the same, it might be equal in the real world. Which suggests to me that we are at substantially more liberty to, if I'm right about this, to influence the course of inequality, even if Professor Piketty's model has a certain underlying truth to it, which I think it probably does. That is to say, the relationship between the rate of return and the growth rate does seem to matter to the movement of inequality. Well, I'm going to make a big leap now. I'm going to move from a discussion of theory to a discussion of evidence. And I'm going to do that without giving you an enormous amount of background on the construction of the evidence. And I want to talk about a data set that I have now, it's now been in existence in original form for almost a decade, but was recently updated to bring the evidence up through 2008 to try and develop a set of measures of inequality which are consistent and which have a lot of coverage around the world. That is to say, which enable us to have a much more precise notion of what actually has happened. The metric is a Gini coefficient. And our objective was to obtain estimates, and these are statistically derived, estimates of a particular concept of inequality, namely that of households in the terms of their gross income. Income including transfers and pensions, not including the effect of taxes, that is to say, on the disposable income side. The way we did this, since the underlying data are basically unavailable, were never collected, was to construct a relationship between that concept and actual measures of inequality in the pay in the manufacturing sector as collected by the United Nations Industrial Organization, Industrial Development Organization, UNIDO. And then he used a regression analysis, which I won't go into, to construct the underlying data set, the final data set. What we have, therefore, is a new panel with almost, well, 3,900, almost just shy of 4,000 country year observations for just shy of 150 countries over this period from 1963 to 2008. If you compare this to other major data sets on inequality, it is vastly more extensive than all of them except one, which is something called this SWIID, Synthetic World Inequality Income Data Set, a World Income Inequality Data Set, which is, however, based on our calculations to a very large extent. So leaving that one aside, the major international data sets that are available are basically two. One of them is the Luxembourg Income Studies, a very good data set, but for a very small number of relatively wealthy countries, and done at great expense. Basically, each calculation requires a lot of trouble to make accurately. And the other one is the Piketty, Saiz, Atkinson Top Incomes Database, which is based on income tax data, and has the limitation that you have to have income tax in order to estimate it, which means it's limited to 29 countries. It gets some long time series, but apart from continental Europe, it's mostly Anglo-Saxon countries around the world that are covered. We do a very different level of coverage. This will give you just a little sample, and it's impossible to read all the Gini coefficients, but the scale is from dark blue to bright red. Across, I don't know, about 25 countries or so on this chart, but there are 150 of them in the data set. And it shows that you can get over time quite a lot of coverage. You can distinguish levels of inequality, and you can distinguish movements of it in the data. That's not a very useful way of conceptualizing what is actually happening. So in order to give you a sense of the movement of inequality, what we do is to take decade averages and then produce maps. And here, I think this becomes a little bit more comprehensible. We have a scale that runs from the very low measures of inequality in the 20s to very high ones in the 40s and 50s, with a clear color scheme from blue, from the cool colors to the hot colors. And we average across each decade in order to get as much coverage as one can get from a particular map. Now, the thesis I want to argue is that inequality did indeed rise in this period, but I will show you later on that the rise is not uniform, and it is not unconditional, and it's not universal either, that there are periods when inequality was declining. Just for the moment, however, just these are just the levels of inequality, and you can see as you move from the 60s to the 1970s, should come along here. There we are, 1970s. The coverage gets a little better, and you can see that as time moves on, inequality begins to rise in the world relative over this period. You can move into the 1980s. You can see it rising sharply in South America, in fact, all over the Central Asian landmass, and move into the 1990s with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the reforms in China. And you can see that the data do, in fact, pick up a generalized increase in inequality. And then this goes up to the, I guess that already was the 2000s. Let me go back up there. Whoop. So there's the final chart in terms of the average value of inequality. So that should give you some feel for how much information. It's obviously not perfect. For a data set of this kind, we're not going to get very much of this. Of West Africa, but over the part of the world for which we have good economic information, the coverage is really very comprehensive. If you take a simple average of the values in this data, you get something like this. And here's my first counter-pickety point. The first counter-pickety point is that the rise in inequality overall is concentrated in a particular period. What's the period? Well, it's not the 1960s, and in the 1970s, actually, we see some declines in the average value. This is not a big decline. Gini points, are very stable. But then from 1980 up until 2000, you see an increase. This stability here is artificial because countries come into the data set at that point, which previously didn't exist, namely the countries of the former Soviet Union, and they start with much lower inequality, so they draw the average down. But over the whole period, if you correct it for that, you have a one big upward sweep. 1980 to 2000. And I would make a very simple point, maybe a couple of very simple points. One of them is that when you see a common movement around the world, there's probably a common cause. Right? It's a very simple argument, which means it's probably not something that's happening that's internal and isolated in a whole stripe of countries just by coincidence, but rather they are being influenced by developments in the world economy as a whole. That's point number one. Point number two is that when you think about this particular period, 1980 to 2000, what is the emerges as the most likely general global development in these years? And I would argue the answer to that is the changing character of global financial governance. That's pretty straightforward. 1971, a stabilized system under the Bretton Woods framework was broken down. In the 1970s, you had a credit boom and a commodities boom. From 1980 to 2000, you had a period of extremely high interest rates and rolling debt crises that broke down the institutional structures, the protections that had previously built up everywhere. The weaker countries first, stronger countries later. Initially, Latin America, Africa, parts of Asia, the debt crisis of the 1980s. Enormous common increases in inequality. You saw that in the maps. Then 1990s, Eastern Europe, Central Europe, Soviet Union. Yeah. Collapse of the system may be a good thing or a bad thing, but it certainly produced a huge increase in inequality, breakdown of previous institutional structures. 1990s, Asia, China in particular. So we have a combination of neoliberal ideology and objective financial forces that bear on the whole world. And that suggests, not surprisingly, that in a world which is globally integrated, at least on the financial plane, countries are subject to common macro forces. It simplifies the analytical problem enormously to think in those terms. Because the data, in some sense, have told you that you don't need to explain things in terms of individual countries. You can explain them in terms of the major movements in terms of a common global economy whose conditions are obviously determined in places like London, New York, and Washington. Okay. What I want to do next is to, an exercise that will maybe perplex and horrify you, maybe just perplex you without horrifying you, but to give you some more confidence in our measures, maybe, to show you some very recent work that we undertook to try and establish whether the calculations that we were making, which are, after all, an estimated series, or any good. So this is a weighty exercise in empirical data accumulation, carried out with great competence by particularly one of my students, but there were several of them that were involved. And it was a very simple thing. Go to the library, pull out every article you can find on country X, that has inequality measures, copy them all down, copy carefully what was actually being measured. Gross income, market income, net income, consumption inequality. Classify these things and then plot them. And you're going to see that this is the color scheme. So black is our measure, green is market, blue is gross, which is the closest to what we measure, red is net, yellow is consumption, and purple is when we don't know what the number is actually because the articles weren't clear about it. And here, for example, is a relatively, you would think, well-organized country, namely Canada. And what do you observe? The data are extremely heterogeneous. You have, this is what runs from, let's see, about 29 up to 50. Extremely high measure or estimates of market income inequality. Very low ones for disposable income inequality. Gross income is in the middle. Ours is really very good, right in the middle of the gross series. Point being, if you wanted to infer anything out of this, you would say, I think, two things. One is that there is a general increase about when I expected it to occur in the 1980s. Secondly, there's still an enormous difference depending upon which concept of inequality you're measuring. And advanced welfare states are always like that. They, generally speaking, have high market income inequality and much lower actual functional disposable income inequality. So no surprise there, it's good data. It's just that different concepts give you very different numbers. And since you're students, I want you to take one lesson out of this. Never, ever write down the Gini coefficient for country X was blank. Unless you specify exactly what is being measured, you could be off by 20 percentage points one way or another, by 20 Gini points one way or another. If you look at Denmark, another small, relatively, you know, we think, well-measured country, you find the same thing. It's basically all the stories are the same. Our data still, our estimates do really well in picking up gross income. The other measures are very diverse depending upon concepts. Denmark has got reasonable stability of income inequality until recent years, strong institutions. If you look at France, the data, in fact, are much worse. In Germany, this is the former DDR, comes to an end in 1989. It had low and declining measured inequality. This is the Federal Republic and the Uniform Germany, rising inequality. And our measure tracks the survey for market income very, very well. Netherlands, go to the United Kingdom, go to the United States. I'll come back to this one in a little while. But the U.S. case, what is interesting and special about the U.S. case is that the measures of market income, of net and gross income and market income, all show these peaks in 2000 and 2007, which are not present in our data, which are based purely on labor incomes. What happens in the U.S. in this period? Stock market boom, real estate boom. Capital asset-based incomes, which are picked up in tax data. We don't see that nearly so much in other countries, but it gives you an important element of why the U.S. measures of inequality appear to be so much higher than other places. Two reasons. We have a lot of capital asset-based income, and we have a good tax system that measures it. Right? There's no Luxembourg in the middle of the United States. You can't get away from the IRS by going to Iowa, for example, or even to Delaware. So, gives you some sense anyway for the quality of the data. I do have Italy here. There's Italy. Again, lots and lots of very disparate measures, or substantially disparate measures for disposable income. And Italy actually shows declining income inequality up until the neoliberal period. I think that's fairly well understood in the literature on Italy. All right. Let me digress for a second, and I'll come back to my first policy story. This is a very nifty measurement technique that we have. Whereas making a comparison out of other people's survey measures is very risky business. Ours gives us the ability to do a lot of, let's say, analysis from readily available data sources that cover a lot of different territory and times, including you can do counties in the United States, so let's go back to the U.S. case. This is county income in the U.S., and it will pick up, again, the peak in 2000, the peak in 2007. Right? And that's what it's showing. If you look at the counties, you find that Wall Street, Manhattan, New York County, New York is a major factor. Silicon Valley, three counties in Northern California, Seattle, another important factors. Take those out. This peak almost goes away. This one is driven by real estate finance. You can pick it out on a map. I don't think you can see the map because of the lighting here, but this is Southern California and this is Florida. Big spikes in income in that particular period as a result of construction activity financed by fraudulent mortgages. If you go to China, to China, we have data that go right up to 2012. Now we have an interesting new finding. Inequality in China starts to decline. Why is that? It's in part because in the early 2000s, the growth of incomes spreads out over more provinces. Instead of just initially Guangdong and Beijing and Shanghai, you get Zhejiang and Tianjin and Fujian and so forth. And after 2008, you get a reduction in the incomes of the top, finance, utilities, and so forth. Overall, reduction in inequality in China. We found it first with these techniques. If you look at Europe, what do you find? In the run-up to the crisis, particularly in the crisis, the inequality across Europe declines. What's going on? This is measured not just at the level of countries, but we do something with this that you can't do with national data, namely add them up over the continent as a whole to get a measure for Europe as a whole by regions and sectors. When you do it by sectors, just six sectors, it becomes very clear what's happened in Europe as a whole. The contribution to inequality in European incomes from the financial sector was reduced in the crisis. Why was that? Well, capital values fell. Right? Where was it reduced in space? It was reduced in space mainly in London. Right? Financial crisis is not good for financial centers, relatively speaking. They make their money before the crisis. So the inequality of incomes in Europe as a whole has a very strong financial component, as it does in China, as it does in the United States. A last empirical point, and then I want to come back to the theoretical proposition, the micro proposition that I raised at the beginning. If one looks at measures based upon pay, which are the most comprehensive ones that we can obtain, and don't require separate estimation techniques, one can move to a very fine analysis of the movement of this measure of inequality over time. And what I want to do now is just present you some maps that show changes. The changes are shades of blue for declines and shades of yellow to red for increases. So can you see all of that? This is the 1960s. In the 1960s, in these measures, most regions, and it's a mixed picture, but most regions of the world, many regions of the world are actually showing declining inequality. Move on into the late 60s and into the 1970s and into the middle 1970s. And you have indeed here substantial declines. This is the commodities boom and debt-financed expansion that I talked about earlier. When you move to the 1980s, bingo, big change. A big reversal in the data, inequality going up, especially dramatically in the debt crisis regions of South America, what we have for Africa, and the beginning to show on China as well. move into the 1990s, and bingo, you can pick up immediately the vast increase in inequality in the former Soviet sphere. It just shows up very clearly. It's a common sense result. It says the movement of inequality is conditional upon events and institutional changes in the world. And then if you go into this is the late 90s, you come up into the 2000s, you have something which looks very much like, I would suggest, the end of the neoliberal period. This gets only up to 2008, so we're not yet in the post-crisis period. But in this data, for which we do not have full conversion into household income inequality, very substantial decreases. China, Russia, parts of Eastern Europe, South Africa, Canada, parts of South America. I think Argentina would show it too if we had good data for that. What's going on? What's going on in the 2000s is a reduction of interest rates and a movement away from a world dominated by the financial center, right? And increasing commodity prices, which permit the commodity producers, particularly Russia, to improve their economic conditions compared to the 1990s. So I just want to suggest, once again, to come back to Piketty, that if you just look at the evidence, you get the idea that, well, maybe things are more controllable than he suggests, more contingent and dependent upon world circumstances and on policies than he allows for. Maybe the 20th century wasn't such an exception. Let me go back, and at the end of the presentation, I'd probably warn you out with data. Let me go back to the proposition number one. The conventional micro view, which I think has been drilled into economic students for a long time, that let the labor market work and you'll get it market clearing with appropriate pricing. And the inequality that results is maybe regrettable, but is a sign of efficiency. I want to suggest to you that even as a matter of theory, that is not the only proposition that you as an economist are entitled to hold. And I'll offer two alternatives. One of them was developed in 1970 by Harris and Todaro, who were analyzing development issues in East Africa. And they made a simple observation, which is that wages were higher in the cities, often because of a minimum wage, than they were in the countryside. And people moved from the countryside to the city. But the city didn't have as many jobs as the countryside, so people moved in the city were unemployed. And that's where unemployment came from. It came out of this inequality in the development process. Well, I ask you, how is that different from modern China, where people move from the countryside to the city by the tens of millions, looking for jobs which some get and others don't? Some get all of the times or some of the time, and others are looking some of the time. They're unemployed. How is that different from Spain after Franco, when people flocked from the countryside to the cities? How is it different from Europe today, in the course of integration, when people move from the south to the north looking for better jobs at better pay? Or from the east, from Poland to Germany, or from Poland to the UK? It's a universal phenomenon. Oh, and the United States in the 1940s and 50s, when the black population of the south moved to the north for industrial jobs. It's exactly the same thing. And there are always more people looking for those jobs than there are jobs. Right? So one can easily believe that the contrary proposition holds, namely that more equal societies tend to have less unemployment than less equal societies. And if you look at that analysis across Europe, you find, well, that's the case. The more egalitarian countries of North Europe have less unemployment characteristically than the less equal countries of South Europe. It's a very reasonable, stable relationship. It's disrupted occasionally, but it's mostly there. Second proposition, specifically drawn from the Scandinavian experience, associated with two economists from the 1950s, Wren and Meidner. And the Meidner-Wren model, or the LO model, Swedish trade union model, was that if you compressed the distribution of pay, you would increase productivity growth. Why? Because companies that could not afford to maintain wage standards would leave or fail. And companies that could afford to do so would expand. And so Sweden grows up with Saab and Scania and all of the advanced machinery industries that it presently has. Not because it had great resources or particularly smart people, but because it imposed, as a matter of standards, solidaristic labor policy that increased the rate of productivity growth. A very general model. Probably can't be done everywhere in the world at once, but the principle that imposing standards raises productivity, therefore makes it possible to have higher incomes in a more equal society, is a very reasonable one, and explains the fact that overall in the world, the richer countries are more equal than the poorer ones. You saw that very clearly on my maps. So I think that's a second perfectly good theoretical proposition. Where does that leave us in terms of policy conclusions? Oh, one other comparison. Let's go back to that comparison between Europe and the United States, which is the linchpin of this analysis, of the conventional analysis. Remember that the linchpin of the conventional analysis was the idea that the United States is far more unequal than Europe in terms of its labor markets. Well, I've given you two clues as to why that might not be the case. One is the one I showed you with the US data, in which the inequality of American incomes is due to capital incomes, not labor incomes, to a very large extent. Maybe the top 8 or 10 Gini points come from the capital market, from Silicon Valley's massive returns and incomes of bankers, rather than the general labor scale. And secondly, remember that in Europe, all the measures that we have are national. They don't include the difference in the average income between Germany and Portugal, or between Norway and Poland. And when you factor that in, the measure of inequality in Europe, European pay scales will go up by about 30% of our population. In that case, Europe is not more equal than the United States. Taken as a continent, Europe is highly unequal. The difference is that inside the United States, the inequality tends to follow particular racial lines. In Europe, it follows national lines. And nationalities live in different places where the races tend to live in the same places. So the US may look more unequal, but it's not necessary. And so there's no reason to believe that the US historical advantage in a lower unemployment rate has to do with more inequality in pay. It may well be that we actually have enjoyed less inequality in pay, which if you think about the history of the country over the 20th century, since the New Deal and the Great Society, would not be a surprise. Those long-standing institutions haven't gone away. So where are we in terms of final policy implications? I would say, for the United States, two policies that are very simple. One is raise the minimum wage. It's an area where the US really lags, is right at the bottom of the pay scale. $7.25, it should be at least 10. 12 would be better. 15 would be better still. And the other is control the bankers, who caused an enormous amount of damage by driving the economy forward with unsustainable, predatory, and fraudulent lending in the period before the crisis, and who have paid essentially no legal price for that behavior. If we did those two things in the US, we would be substantially ahead of where we are now. As far as Europe is concerned, well, The European problem, if I'm correct, is that the inequality that really matters is the inequality on transnational lines. This is very important. It is the disadvantage that the poorer countries of Europe have with respect to the richer ones, which has been aggravated and continues to be aggravated by the politics of austerity. The richer countries have been able to stabilize themselves because they are rich, because their institutions remain more or less intact. And the poorer ones have been forced increasingly to retrench, and their institutions are cracking. Their institutions, their social structures are clearly cracking under the stress. True in Greece, true in Spain. Italy is an interesting example because while the stress is very great, Italy is neither poor nor small. And if the policy is going to be changed for Europe as a whole, the place that that change will start is right here. And it will start by insisting, and I think my friend Giuseppe Guarino is correct on this point, by insisting that the Maastricht Treaty does not impose austerity, that the Maastricht Treaty is built upon the premise of sustainable growth, and if that premise is not met, then the treaty isn't worth anything. But since that is the premise of the treaty, the government of Italy is quite correct in rejecting the notion that it is forced by its obligations to enter into continually destructive economic policy. Thanks very much.